This is Fronteras, a public radio collaboration that brings you stories about the Southwest and life near the U.S.-Mexico border. I'm Joy Palacios with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This week, Mexican police say they captured one of the most important leaders of the violent Zetas drug cartel, Omar Trevino Morales. Federal authorities blame the Zetas for carving a path of brutality and bloodshed along the border. Both countries had offered multi-million dollar rewards for the arrest of Morales, known as Z-42. Police captured him during a pre-dawn raid in a wealthy suburb near Monterrey. His arrest follows the recent apprehension of another big cartel leader, Servando Gomez, known as La Tuta, who reportedly runs the Knights Templar drug gang. Combating the drug trade takes money, and the four states bordering Mexico are in a funding standoff with the federal government over just that. California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas rely on federal dollars to prosecute drug cases sent to them by U.S. agents. Now, a Texas county is refusing to accept cases from the U.S. Border Patrol checkpoints. That's having a ripple effect in state courts across the Southwest, as Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon reports.
We're driving up to the U.S. Border Patrol's internal checkpoint at Sierra Blanca, Texas. It's sometimes called Checkpoint to the Stars because people such as Willie Nelson, Snoop Lion, and Fiona Apple have been arrested here after dogs detected marijuana.
How are you doing today, U.S. Border Patrol?
The three weren't prosecuted federally. The cases were sent to the state because the amounts involved weren't worth the federal government's time. They paid their fines and court costs and were on their way within hours. Multiply that by thousands, and you see why this once made for a sweet deal for cash-strapped Hudspeth County, Texas. The federal government reimbursed the county for handling cases federal prosecutors didn't want. In Texas border counties, numerous sources say that if the amount of marijuana seized falls below 44 pounds, the state's called in to prosecute. And the first gatekeeper in the state legal system is the county.
And we'll all do it if it'll make us a little money. In the beginning, it made us money.
That's the county prosecutor here, Kit Bramlett.
And by God, the first check we got was $2 million?
That was in 2002. The Department of Justice was handing money to the four states bordering Mexico to handle federally initiated cases. But that program, the Southwest Border Prosecution Initiative, sent out its last check in 2013. The federal government, though, continued to send cases to the state until a DEA grant to the county ended. Here's Hudspeth County Judge Mike Doyle.
They said, we're not renewing the grant, so we quit taking the cases.
And so the county isn't accepting any federal narcotics cases, period.
The old expression is, you know, you caught this cat, you skin it. I don't have any objections about skinning that cat for them, as long as they're going to pay for it.
The Center for Investigative Reporting in California says its analysis of government data shows that between 2005 and 2011, 88% of the drug seizures at Sierra Blanca, mostly for marijuana, fell below federal thresholds. That meant major revenue for the county. It was paid for handling federally initiated cases in state courts, and it made money in county court on fines levied in lower-level misdemeanor cases. Then the arrangement fell apart.
It concerns me greatly.
Doyle says the county's made a necessary but difficult decision.
Law enforcement, whether it be state, federal, or local, is a major contributor to the economy of this county, and I hate to say that, but it is.
The county's taken the same tack before. For 3 weeks in 2012, the Border Patrol says that more than 24 people caught with small amounts of marijuana were relieved of their drugs and released at the checkpoint without facing any legal penalties.
Federal agents have long relied on state and local criminal justice actors to pick up the slack on smaller drug cases.
Jennifer Chacon at the University of California Irvine School of Law says the Texas case isn't unfolding in a vacuum.
What we're seeing happening here is also part of a broader set of developments that have been caused by congressional choices about funding law enforcement, particularly along the southern border.
There are no plans in Congress to fund the four border states that take on federal drug cases. And Chacon says that as a matter of constitutional law, the federal government can't force a county to bring charges under state law.
It is telling that we see this happening in Hudspeth County, in the state of Texas, which has drug laws aligned with the federal government's own zero-tolerance approach.
Chacon says it will be increasingly difficult for the government to get support in states like California, where drug laws are more tolerant. The U.S. Attorney's Office here declined comment. The DEA and the Department of Homeland Security are prosecuting some of the marijuana cases once sent to the state, causing budget constraints in those agencies a feeling one Texas county says it knows all too well. I'm Lorne Madelon in Sierra Blanca, Texas.
Now to the U.S.-Mexico border near California, where a San Diego nursing home is trying to identify a patient who's been on life support for more than a decade. Officials believe the man was crossing into the United States, and the vehicle he was riding in crashed. Joanne Ferrion of iNews Source reports the man's caretakers are releasing information about him as they try to locate his family.
Let's start with his name. Legally, it's 66 Garage. 66 is his first name, Garage his last. The story of how he ended up here, living in this bed at the Villa Coronado Skilled Nursing Facility for the past 15 years, a breathing tube in his throat, a feeding tube in his stomach, and how he got his name begins about 100 miles east of San Diego. Mark Steingart is a social worker at Villa Coronado.
My understanding is that he was living in Mexico, crossed the border illegally.
According to medical records, 66 Garage was traveling in a van near El Centro when it crashed in June 1999. He wasn't wearing a seatbelt and was thrown from the vehicle. He was eventually transferred to the UCSD Trauma Center. He was severely brain damaged and spent a year in the hospital. That's where he was given the name 66 Garage. A hospital official says it's common for patients who are not alert or awake, who have no ID, to be assigned a random name until their identities are known.
Rumor has it that when the van was in bad disrepair, it was taken to the city impounding where they fix vans that were in accidents, and the name of the garage that it was in was 66 Garage.
No one knows for sure whether that story is true, but it's the lore that has become part of Garage's personal history, as staff at the nursing home try to fill in the blanks about a young man with no past. Ed Kirkpatrick is the director of the nursing home.
Many times we all wonder, you know, where did you come from? What was your life like?
Garage doesn't speak or respond to commands, but he can sometimes follow movements with his big brown eyes. Medi-Cal, the state program for the sick and disabled, pays for Garage's care about $700 a day. A team of doctors and administrators make all his health care decisions.
Our job is to keep him alive and keep him at his highest state of being. If certain things were to happen, his heart stopped, he stopped breathing, we would not be continuing or doing life-sustaining measures. Otherwise, he could be with us for 15 more years.
Since he's been at Villa Coronado, seven people have come forward, believing Garage was a relative. Among the most recent was Yolanda Abarilera, who lives in Texas.
He did have a lot of similarities with my brother. Almost everyone was almost sure it was him because they coincided in a lot of things. The age, the time that they'd been missing.
She believed he could have been her brother, also last heard from trying to cross the border some 16 years ago. Abarilera even traveled to San Diego to see Garage.
I'll never forget his face. When he saw me, he took my hand and he squeezed it very hard, and I know he was trying to tell me something. Maybe he tried to tell me that he's not my brother, but for me to help him find his family.
A DNA test showed the two were not a match. An iNews Source investigation last year revealed there are more than 4,000 people living on special life support units across California. 66 Garage is one of eight whose identities are unknown. Staff at the nursing home have tried to change Garage's name, but it could jeopardize his medical benefits. By releasing more information, the nursing home believes it might get a new lead on his identity and reunite him with his family. They hope one day they'll be able to call 66 Garage by his given name. In San Diego, I'm Joanne Ferrien.
Crossing the border from Mexico to the United States often means crossing the Rio Grande River, which runs along 1,200 miles of the international boundary. The Pueblo of Islita in central New Mexico sits near the boundary. It's a Native American community between Kirkland Air Force Base and the city of Albuquerque. The Rio Grande runs through the middle of the tribe's ancestral land, the bedrock of their cultural heritage. Ed Williams reports Pueblo residents worry pollution is contaminating the river, which they regard as sacred.
Ask a resident of Isleta Pueblo how the tribe's relationship with the Rio Grande has changed over the years, and you're likely to hear something like this.
I grew up, we didn't have any of this source, but the river, we drank water out of the river, okay? That's not a good idea. In fact, we have warning signs not to even be in the river.
That's Pueblo native and tribal councilman James Abeda. He lives on a small farm about 4 miles south of Albuquerque. He's one of many Isleta Pueblo farmers who use water from the river to grow crops like chile, corn, and squash.
Our meals traditionally are around the things that we grew, okay?
Water pollution is a consistent concern for farmers here. They find themselves trying to reconcile their beliefs that the river is sacred with concerns about contaminants washing downstream. Government records show that over the past year, 8 facilities upstream from the tribe have been in violation of the Clean Water Act. That's the federal law that regulates river pollution. Those violations are for things like releasing undertreated sewage and spilling chlorine into the river.
It basically takes away the significance of our beliefs because of somebody else spoiling the one matter that we depend on, and that's the water.
Abeda and others worry that river pollution could harm people who eat the crops that are grown on the Pueblo. So far, there haven't been any studies on the subject, so there's no way to know if people are getting sick. But Isleta Tribal Council Secretary Verna Teller says pollution in the Rio Grande has definitely affected another aspect of the tribe's way of life, the religious ceremonies that take place in the river.
Our ceremonial and religious culture here in our community is of utmost importance to us. That's what's kept us who we are as a people. And so when there's any threat to that, it's very frightening for our people. It's a threat to our existence as far as we're concerned.
Teller says at times the Rio Grande has been visibly polluted to the point that they've had to stop using the river water for ceremonies. That's improved somewhat over the years, she says, but thumbing through a stack of federal environmental reports on Albuquerque's wastewater treatment plant and other upstream facilities, she questions how much progress has actually been made.
I can't, you know, just these numbers scare me, makes me want to cry. I don't know if we're going to get this city or even the city of Santa Fe to stop these violations.
So there you go. There's our 50 million gallons a day coming into the Rio Grande.
That's Jeff Romanowski, chief engineer at Albuquerque's Southside Water Treatment Plant. He's standing by a stream of clear, treated wastewater that's flowing into the muddy Rio Grande, not far upstream from Isleta's border. The plant had multiple E. coli violations last year and has had many more issues in the past, according to the Environmental Protection Agency.
So violations are bad in general. Any violation that we do have, we have to report within 24 hours to the EPA.
The water utility is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to overhaul outdated equipment at the plant, and officials there say that will bring them into full compliance with the Clean Water Act. But the city's wastewater treatment plant is only one of many nearby sources of pollution that could flow into the Rio Grande, according to the EPA. To name a few, Rio Rancho's wastewater treatment plant has been in violation of environmental laws for years. The city of Albuquerque has at times drained high levels of aluminum, PCBs, and arsenic into the watershed through stormwater drains, and over the past decade, more than 700 pounds of lead has legally washed into the Rio Grande watershed from Kirtland Air Force Base. Reporting from Albuquerque, I'm Ed Williams.
Several decades ago, Isleta Pueblo imposed strict water quality standards on Albuquerque's wastewater treatment plant because of health concerns downstream. The water utility is still struggling to meet those standards today. Coming up on Fronteras, Ed Williams continues his report on pollution along the Rio Grande River.
No matter how good of an operator you are, if you don't have equipment that can support the process, you're going to have problems.
And we check out a band leader in San Antonio who goes behind the scenes of the Latino arts community with his podcast, Radio Bamba.
From downtown San Antonio, Texas, this is Radio Bamba.
That's next on Fronteras. This is Fronteras. I'm Joey Palacios. Businesses, military bases, and city utilities have dozens of permits to release pollution into the Rio Grande watershed. Albuquerque's wastewater treatment plant is one of the biggest sources discharging into the river. From the Fronteras desk, Ed Williams continues his report on pollution into the Rio Grande. The city plant has had trouble with regulators and neighboring communities in the past, but they're making some headway.
We got 6.28 milligrams per liter of DO.
It's a sunny day in Albuquerque's South Valley, and water utility workers are bent over a grate taking readings of the city's treated wastewater as it rushes from the Southside Water Reclamation Plant into the Rio Grande. This is the point where, at any given day, 50 million gallons of water flow back into the river after being flushed down the toilets and washed down the drains of Albuquerque's homes and businesses.
So today's reading was good.
Very good, yeah. And like I said, that's typical.
On this day, the measurements are well within the legal range. And Jeff Romanowski, the plant's chief engineer, says that's how things usually are here. But the news isn't always good.
Yeah, we had some problems. You know, we had some issues. And that's one reason we wanted to do a lot of this rehab, because we knew we had some structural problems with the equipment.
The utility is spending $250 million on upgrades to fix the outdated equipment that has led, along with other issues, to violations of the Clean Water Act.
No matter how good of an operator you are, if you don't have equipment that can support the process, you're going to have problems.
The Environmental Protection Agency has issued the water utility 3 formal orders to fix problems at the plant since 2010. At one point, it was listed on the agency's national watch list of troubled facilities.
That is the Aceque Madre, which is the mother ditch, and it channeled to north end of the reservation.
James Abeda is an Isleta Pueblo farmer who irrigates his crops with river water not far downstream from the treatment plant. Several decades ago, tribal authorities there began raising concerns about strange smells and foam drifting down the river. After legal battles with the city that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, the tribe imposed their own strict water quality standards on the plant. Things have gotten much better at the plant since then, but Abeda says Isleta has little patience for any new violations.
Albuquerque has to be held accountable. Albuquerque has to step up and adhere to the water standards that we've got.
But adhering to those standards is not always easy, says Water Utility Operations Chief John Stomp.
Our permit is probably, if not the most stringent permit in the southwestern United States, it's got to be way up there.
Stomp says the overall performance of the plant is very good, and that the 18 EPA violations they got over the past year are based on inaccurate records, except for some occasional E. coli violations. And it's worth mentioning here that it was high levels of E. coli in the river that led the EPA to classify a downstream stretch as unsafe for recreation and for some wildlife. But still, Stomp points out the wastewater coming out of the treatment plant is cleaner than the river it's flowing into.
Could you guys, why don't you guys go get this filled up to 25 milliliters, that line right there?
Rich Schrader monitors the Rio Grande below the Albuquerque plant for the environmental nonprofit RiverSource. His tests have turned up worrisome results for fecal bacteria and phosphorus that he says could be coming from the city's wastewater. But there are many other and probably more serious kinds of pollution flowing into the river, even when the plant is working perfectly.
Estrogen, hormone mimickers from soaps, Viagra, all these elements are emerging contaminants that they do not take out at the wastewater treatment plant. That water can go into people's irrigation ditches and get into their farm fields and potentially be taken up by the food.
But that's hard to gauge. Water pollution is a murky subject, and you can't always see it. There are so many questions that we can't answer yet, and that's partly because there's not much data out there. The government measures water contamination in the Rio Grande only once every 8 years. Reporting from Albuquerque, I'm Ed Williams.
Now to San Antonio, where the strong Latino presence influences everything from food to language to the arts. That's where the band leader of the group Bombasta is going behind the scenes to interview artists and creative people for a podcast that's getting a lot of attention. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan sat down with Robert Livar, the host of Radio Bamba.
It's got a kind of a retro feel to it.
From downtown San Antonio, Texas, this is Radio Bomba.
If he sounds familiar, there's a reason.
This is Robert Livard with Bombasta.
You may know him from his other endeavor, Bombasta Barrio Big Band. You and I gotta help each other out. Gotta come together, try to work things out. We work out black, white, what the heck is Radio Bomba?
It's a podcast, roughly about 30-minute conversations between myself and some of San Antonio's culture creators.
He chooses interesting artists, then goes to the upstairs studio at the iconic Alamo Music Company and records them.
The first podcast I put out, I reached out to Alvaro del Norte from Piñata Protest, Conjunto Punk Rock, and, you know, we talked about him smashing accordions on stage. Great, you smashed an accordion on stage, but where'd you get that accordion? And it's great to get past the sound bites.
Radio Bomba presents the creators of the written word, the sung word, and music in general, but not necessarily the mainstream.
And a lot of the artists who are making good art, good music that interests me tend to be on the fringes there.
But perhaps a little less so now. LeVar produces new podcasts every week. In San Antonio, this is Jack Morgan for Fronteras.
And that's it for this Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. We leave you with more music from Bombasta. You can find the show at tpr.org or under the Programs tab. Our producers are Shelley Koffler and Alexis Yancey. Chiranga Cakewalk composed the Fronteras theme music. I'm Joey Palacios in San Antonio, Texas.